IVM.
Hello and welcome to the Ganatantra podcast. I am Sariyo Natarajan.
And I'm Alok Prasanna Kumar.
And in this week's episode, we will be discussing the coronavirus lockdown. Usually, Alok and I make it a point to discuss and have record every episode where we are together. But thanks to the social distancing norms that are in place and the lockdown that's in place, we're actually sitting in our own homes and recording. It's an incredible privilege to be at home, given some of what has unraveled as a result of the lockdown, which are things that we hope to talk about. We hope to look at the lockdown, its implications in the context of federalism, which relates to some of our earlier episodes this season. We also look at the lockdown and its consequences with respect to institutions and a few other topics such as data governance.
So before we begin, just again, to clarify, we are not medical experts. We can't tell you how to keep yourself safe from COVID-19. We can't tell you what to do if you feel the symptoms. But we were discussing this earlier this week, and we felt that it's not as if the virus has affected everyone equally. It has affected different people differently. And the government response, it sort of tells you something about the nature of politics and the nature of policy. That is not just about looking at the data and acting on the basis of that data. There are political calls being taken. And as much as we may say this is purely to save people's lives, whose lives are to be saved and at what cost are political calls being taken by governments, not just in India, but around the world. And what we hope to leave you with at the end of this about half an hour of episode that we have planned, we want you to be able to think about on what basis are government taking these calls, that you don't just assess it on the basis of this went right or this went wrong, but how are governments taking these calls and how do we judge whether they made the right call or wrong call?
Absolutely. And I think that placing it in context in terms of the politics that are in play in the country today is very critical, not just because it gives you a lens into the ways in which the state governments respond or sort of various levels of the federal structure respond to this. But it also gives you a sense of how things may be in the future, because it looks like, at least from what we understand, and again, to Alok's point, we're not really experts, but it looks like this might be fairly long drawn. It might there's a lot of compelling evidence suggesting that this is not over on April 15th, and to think about the ways in which this could impact even future actions from various aspects of the government, various governments at the state level or at the city level in India.
And when we see state and city level, we actually, if you go back a week actually feels like a month ago. But if you actually go back a couple of weeks, we see that a lot of state governments have started imposing initial versions of the lockdown by themselves. Karnataka, at least, Maharashtra, Delhi, and Kerala, of course, had started taking measures at least to say, okay, we're shutting down schools and education institutions, we're shutting down stores, restaurants, and so on, much before the union government had stepped in and done anything. And the union government had, of course, sort of taken some measures leading to the airports and so on. But again, the pattern that we're seeing around the world is that regional and municipal governments, right, at the state level, at the city level in India, have been taking calls to do put in lockdowns or take measures to fight COVID-19 much before this current nationwide lockdown has been imposed. And I think one great example actually comes from the district of Kalburgi in the north of Karnataka, which was like a classic example of how both this federal structure messed up the whole exercise and also how it provided an answer to the situation. We saw the situation where elderly gentleman came in from Saudi Arabia, land in Hyderabad, because Kalburgi is actually much closer to Hyderabad than it is to Bangalore, and went across state borders to his home. There was no way for the Karnataka state government to have any eyes on him as to this person has come in from Saudi Arabia to Karnataka, and Telangana government would have lost sight of him once he crossed the border. His treatment was completely botched up because he was treated at private hospitals and government hospitals, discharged from one, sent to the other. And, he sort of traveled back and forth between Hyderabad and Kalburgi. And what eventually happened was that he came into contact with a lot of people because he was a well-known preacher, came into contact with a lot of people in his district and in the city of Kalburgi, when he was diagnosed as being positive, as having the COVID virus when he passed away, it caused a bit of a panic in the district. And the district was basically locked down, right? Before even the national lockdown was imposed, the complete district was locked down. And so far, we've only seen about 3 or 4 cases from that state. They were able to trace the contacts, monitor the people. It was quite a large number, but they were at least able to effectively prevent it from spreading it to surrounding districts. We know the success or failure of these measures sometime in a couple of weeks, but something similar also happened in the district of Bhilwara in Rajasthan, where again, they found that doctors had been diagnosed with it. And because doctors had seen so many patients, they had to go literally house to house to find out, is there anyone with symptoms? Have they traveled anywhere? You know, what is there someone we should put under quarantine or keep under observation? But these are measures taken by the district administrations themselves. These are measures taken by the state governments themselves to take charge of the situation and see, okay, can we limit the impact of what is going on? But they can't do this on their own. And I think so this is the United States. The United States is realizing the effect of this, because even as much as the federal government, as we speak, has not imposed any such thing like a national lockdown as India has, various state governments there, the governors especially, are imposing lockdowns in their particular state, some version of the lockdowns, to ensure that people, that this disease doesn't spread and they're able to manage the load. So we are sort of seeing how a federal structure can be put under strain and how it responds to situations like this.
Absolutely. And I think the other point to note here is that cities have been the first sites of spread of these kinds of infections. It was observed in the case of SARS as well. It's true of COVID too, mainly because it's brought in by international travelers, most likely landing in cities and residing in them. And this highlights another sort of important tier of government, which we've discussed in previous episodes, but is worthwhile to talk about, which is the municipal government, which at the city level is responsible for a range of services to citizens and a range of sort of governance aspects, such as sanitation, such as aspects of public health, even some aspects of transportation are locally managed. And to think about that level of governance and in its often its inability to enforce some of the things that might be most relevant at the city level is also worth considering. So if you look at the first sort of sites of cities, they're places from or in places to which international travelers have arrived. So it's really that level of the municipal level of governance, which is also critical in terms of thinking about the way in which, levels of government need to sort of kick in to address the questions around COVID.
Yeah, and here I will point out to two of our recent episodes, and I think one which sort of listeners are advised to see to hear once again and rethink some of the things that you heard in light of what is happening around you. One is Pranay Kotastane's fantastic discussion with us on municipal government, and not just municipal government, but devolution of funds and fiscal federalism, about, as we called it, the 2.5 lakh governments in India. Which sort of tells you about the capacity and the lack of ability at a lot of this state and a lot of city and rural governments. But also Chinmay Tumbe's excellent episode on migration. I think one of the things that we are sort of seeing right now, and it's happened in the last 3-4 days since the lockdown was imposed, was that suddenly cities are waking up, and cities and states also are waking up to realizing, oh my God, this is how many interstate migrant labor is present in our city. And in as much as, say, states from Kerala to Delhi are trying to convince them to stay in place, not to try and move out and go back home, it's hard to convince people, especially when they determined to move and in such large numbers. You're not talking about 4 or 5 people whom you can help, or even just in the order of hundreds, you're talking about lakhs of people across the country.
Yes, and one of the sources of this problem has been the lack of coordination, particularly in terms of the release of the census data on migration, right? I joke about this. I would have written a different PhD if the census 2011 census data had been available in the last decade. The migration data, the D tables were not made available for a very long time, and I think they were only recently released after I had submitted my PhD. And so to think about how state governments would enact these decisions without the adequate information, I mean, even 2011 data is probably outdated, but it's definitely more indicative than 2001 data. So it's critical that the state is informed in making these decisions. And, you know, that brings us to the point around the question of where are people coming from, where are people going. Chinmay does some amazing work in his book as well, India Moving, which he talks about in the episode that Alok mentioned, where, you know, he highlights how much interstate, intrastate movement there is of people. And to think that it is possible to impose or sort of bring in place a lockdown or a shelter in place, I think that's the term that's used in look how much war terminology we have at our disposal. But, you know, shelter in place is really hard, because what does place even mean in this context is something to think about.
Yeah, and a lot of interstate migrants. And again, keep in mind, we're talking about people who are probably doing this on a semi-permanent basis.
Of course.
Every year they will come for a few months, do the work in the cities and go back to their villages in time for harvest or, you know, in time for other village purposes. So it's not as if it's a one and done situation. They come for a few months in one day and they go back forever. They keep doing this again and again, which is why I use the term semi-permanent. But they have some settings where they know this is where I will go to find work. This is where I know I will stay. This is where I can make my arrangements. But when things go really bad, such as at this present moment, when you're not sure you're going to get any work, you're not sure you're going to make rent in that place, you want to go back. The government can say, okay, you know what? You don't have to worry about rent. You don't have to worry about food. But for a lot of people, they're like, thank you, but I can't stay crammed in this place with seven other men, for the next however long you want to tell me to, just on the basis that I might get a couple of meals a day. I need to go back, and I need to go back home because it's a worrying situation for me. So in a sense, what this crisis has also unveiled, you know, apart from all the discussions on public health and federalism, it has also told us something very fundamental about the nature of migration in India and the concerns of migrant labor. And how they are invisible to the government. I mean, it's not as if the government does not want to acknowledge their existence, although there are people who would say that the government refuses to acknowledge their existence, but also that the government just cannot see them. It doesn't have mechanisms to address their needs, to understand why they're coming, how to make their lives better, and so on. And now, when you've taken a decision with such wide-ranging implications across the country, like possibly with demonetization, but except to be 10 times more impactful, you find that because you don't see this set of people, the decision has gone awry in so many different ways, and in ways you can't imagine. And we've seen the images from the Anand Vihar ISBT, and today people were sharing images from Kerala where thousands of migrant labor have turned up in the streets saying, you know, we just want to be allowed to go home. You're great, you're doing whatever you're great, but, you know, we're just too worried to want to stay here anymore. There's no for us, no work for us. We don't want to risk it, and we just want to go back home.
Yes, I think that there's, you know, to sort of talk back about the wide literature there is about circular migration. There's Shivramakrishnan, I want to say. We will link the paper in the show notes. There are papers that talk about circulatory migration. There's Ian Bremen's fantastic work on migration. So there's a lot of literature that documents the plight of migrants. So the invisibilization of migration in that sense, in the current way in which the lockdown has been brought into place, is indeed both a problem of data as well as, in some ways, I would hesitate to sort of certify that as the reason, but perhaps a lack of political will to see migration and migrants as somebody who's or a set of people whose needs have to be specifically addressed. Circulatory migration is, for instance, I don't know if in the summer, it's actually just the time now, this fruit called the nunga, which you get all over the streets of Bangalore, is all circular migrants who come from across the border in Tamil Nadu, going back at the end of the season, either for farm work or for, for a range of other types of employment that they may have access to in their home state. So to think about even the point of time at which that this has been imposed is really something that that would have required a lot more deliberate thought.
Yeah.
And a lot more data, which I think is another point to speak of, because, and this has been mentioned several times, if the same set of inputs were available with much more data, would we have arrived at the same conclusion around the lockdown? So there's that sort of thinking as well that needs to be addressed, because for an action that has as much impact as this is having, it is critical to think about the ways in which alternative solutions could also have been imagined. Though one must not go down the path of counterfactuals, but you know, at this present moment, it's worth being entirely sure that this is the right way to address the situation.
And in some senses, Rosario, I have a lot of sympathy. Nobody can accuse me of this. Sometimes some people do. I do have sympathy for state and central governments which have to take decisions in this regard. For one, they don't have data from their own country. Right? We're looking at curves from Italy, from Spain, from the US, from China, from South Korea, from Japan, countries which are in no way like in any particular way that you want to slice and dice it. And going, what do we do if this happens here? And the difficult thing for them is, will this happen here? And how do we know what happens here? And because the situation is changing so fast that, you know, in a span of 1 month, we've gone from, say, 10 cases of COVID-19 in India to 1,000 cases approximately. And in as much as that may seem like a terrifying growth, it's actually not as bad as most other countries. Now, is that reason to be a little bit complacent about this? Or is that reason to now say, you know what, we need to ensure that this stays this way, so let's go the other extreme? It's a difficult call. And I think making this decision is not something that, you know, has like a perfect outcome that we'll somehow manage to ensure every that there's no large-scale spread and at the same time the economy is not affected. So this is and the point, of course, being that the data is not something that can definitively guide you. You say, this is exactly what you must do. Governments have to take a call on the basis, and I guess at some point, which data looks right. Now, if people in government are sufficiently capable and understand how to read and interpret the data, they will probably get more things right than wrong. But at the end of the day, they still have to apply the data to reality. They just can't see it out of context. And what we've just been discussing, to understand that when you sort of think about it, and to put it in the crudest and most stark terms, the choice, I think, before an Indian policymaker, any at state or central level, essentially comes down to this. How do I ensure the deaths from COVID-19 are kept to a minimum without causing deaths by starvation? I mean, that's the crudest way that I can put it. And I think that is really the tough question facing Indian policymakers. And, you know, data can help them make a better call, but it can't tell you what call.
Of course, I think that shouldn't even be the goal, especially when you need a rapid response. I don't think you can have a perfect answer, and there is no counterfactual in this case at all, which is that there is no alternative scenario with which you can compare. In fact, the comparables, like Japan is sometimes thrown up as a comparison. India did seem to adopt some of the earlier strategies of limiting testing, which Japan also did. But how can you compare a country with such a small population to ours, plus a range of other social factors? So absolutely, I think the idea is to be able to say, in what way is the availability of data also political? And there's a problem, because there's one, which is that there is data which relates to the census, which might have informed the whole trajectory. This is not to say that it wasn't considered, but there's also data that resides at the state level and data that resides at the municipal level, which might also inform. And so given that there is a set of three tiers of government, or two and a half, as you sometimes say, Alok, tiers of government, it's critical to think about what intelligence resides where, and in what way can it all be brought together, marshaled together to inform the right kind of decision making. So there's that aspect of data which can inform the decision. But there's also another thing that one needs to speak about in the context of data, and that relates to data about individuals. What we are seeing now in the context of the lockdown, particularly with respect to strategies like tracing and quarantining, is a large amount of data being extracted in the name of public safety. And there is a set of concerns that arise in that context, and that relates to whether this can ever be rolled back, and what that data has actually meant in the way that the state has balanced the interests of public health versus the privacy of citizens. So there's that aspect. And what this is also leading to is, because the boundaries between the state and citizens is porous in the era of WhatsApp. There are also instances of this kind of information being used against citizens to threaten, harass, and even enable vigilante actions. We saw, very recently, I think this was about 2 days ago, information about a couple that was COVID positive in a part of Bangalore, with videos and photos of them being circulated on a range of WhatsApp groups in the area, which relates to another set of problems that arise with respect to data. This has nothing to do with the state's informed decision making, but has to do very much with how the state reacts once there are a set of instances or diagnosed cases. So that's also a point to consider. It speaks to some of the episodes we've done over the past 2 years, but I think it's also an independent concern that has sort of an exceptional appearance or a manifestation in this particular case.
Yeah, and there has been, I think, two, especially since we're in Bangalore, I think two big decisions or moves by the government which have come under some fairly serious scrutiny. One is, of course, their decision to release the names of people who have been placed under quarantine. Remember, these are not people who have tested positive. These are people who have been required to be quarantined because they travel from a country outside India which had COVID-19, which had probably instances of COVID-19 and so on.
Alok, they've made an app also on top of it.
They have made an app on top of it, exactly.
Yeah.
They've made an app where you can actually check out, and I happen to use this app. The app doesn't give names, to be fair. The app doesn't give names. The app just simply says you put in your PIN code and you find out how many people in your area are supposed to be self-quarantined. Now, this is without context, this can be a very scary app for people to use, because if I find out, like say, in my area, Wiley Kavu, that there are, in my PIN code, that there are about 463 people are supposed to be quarantined, you will panic, right? You're not told who are these, of course, you don't need to know who they are, but you're not told what is making them quarantined. Is it because they've traveled outside, they've come in contact with someone, or are they related to someone? You don't know anything of that. You just know 463 people are quarantined and can be a very terrifying measure. So even without the names and stuff, which is, has all these possible dangers of vigilantism and so on, there is also a risk that this could in fact cause spread more panic. But I think the second move, which has also come in for some level of criticism, let's say at the moment, is the government, state government here decided to move from issuing physical passes to individuals who had to turn up. I mean, the absurdity of this, where you're trying to enforce lockdown to ensure that there is distancing, but then you ask everyone to queue up before the local DSP office to get your movement passes. Kind of defeating the purpose of it. So they said, okay, fine, e-passes. But promptly they went and signed an MOU of some sort with MyGame, which is a startup which specializes in limiting entry and access to apartment complexes. And there's a different issue to be discussed. But suddenly you have a private player being involved in this, who has access to data. You're not sure what is the terms on which they have access to data. Have they worked out the processes? Have they ensured that the data will be protected? How do you make sure it's not being used for profit later?
Yes.
This raises so many questions. Right? I mean, I
there's
understand.
No, yeah, there's no tendering. There's no, it seems to be, so I've looked at what the MyGate website says on this, if we can have a little segue into talking about this particular application. Other city governments and state governments have, police departments have moved towards an online curfew pass system, just for the very reasons that you mentioned. It would be the death of irony if you said curfew passes in an era of social distancing in person. So the objection is not so much to the digitization of this, though there are some questions around that as well, but around the ways in which data are being shared. And there's not really much clarity in terms of who owns the data, whether it can be further monetized. It seems to be goodwill. So what happens if it is indeed monetized in the wrong way? So there are a set of concerns around privacy and data sharing. There's no purpose limitation that is placed, which can be enforced, which raises questions about what this even means. And there was no tendering process, right? MyGate, I think, volunteered to do this, and they therefore are doing it.
And to be fair, let's acknowledge this one thing: there is a capacity issue in our governments, right? You think that surely, with the government which has been like this, which has overseen the startup growth, they might have developed some internal capacity to do this, but they haven't. and perhaps they're not able to deploy that capacity fast enough. But for whatever reason it is, when you have the private sector step in to fill a certain gap in government capacity, there's a need to think it through. Not to say that it's necessarily bad, but it's not necessarily so. But when it comes to, especially in emergency situations such as this, and when you're talking about handling people's data, there is a need to be extra careful. And the rightly people are raising questions. And one hopes as the government, you know, sort of responds to various situations as they arise, when they rope in private players and private parties, that they think some of these questions through and come up with ways to address some of the issues that people have over the handling of data.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there's very much the danger that we move into realms of disaster capitalism in the inclusion of the private sector. And I hesitate to use the word because it carries a lot of connotations with it. But it must not be such that somebody is profiting from the situation in a way that is extractive of people's data or extractive of sort of people's resources. And this is a danger that is to be guarded for as much as actual questions, instrumental questions of data sharing, privacy and purpose limitations that should be anyway a part of how data sharing is done in any context. So that's absolutely critical in terms of thinking about the current crisis.
And finally, you know, one point before we sort of end this episode, you have this somewhat absurd set of hashtags going around on Twitter demanding that the government impose an emergency under the constitution or take over some states' finances using the powers under Article 360. And leaving that aside, we are in fact in an emergency situation. So just and because I used the word, I thought we should just discuss this a little bit. The concept of emergency powers is not like exhausted in the Constitution. There are three kinds of emergencies in the Constitution. You have Article 56, which provides for taking over of a state's, the president's rule in a state when the state government is impossible through, because the Constitution government is not possible for various reasons. You have the emergency which can be imposed now post the emergency in 75 for external security threats or internal rebellion. And you have provisions for like a financial emergency where, a state's finances can be sort of managed by the center where it feels that's not done well. But that is not the only place in our laws and in our constitutional system that you will find governments being given emergency powers. If you look at it that way, the National Disaster Management Act, in fact, gives the union government emergency powers. Now, it was not intended to be applied uniformly across the country, as it has been for the purposes of COVID-19. But it effectively gives the government power to, you know, run a particular district or a set of districts or the state. I mean, I'm simplifying it a lot. But the concept of emergency powers, you have to understand, is not just something that, say, is to be considered the same as imposing an emergency under the Constitution. Emergency powers are where the regular system of, rules and laws and procedures and checks and balances are suspended temporarily just so that you can preserve these systems of rules and checks and balances. And it actually goes back to the Roman Republic when the position of a dictator was known, and the Roman Senate would hand over powers to this dictator in times of war, famine, disease to ensure that they overcame this situation, and powers were handed back at the end of this tenure until Julius Caesar came over and didn't hand back and became an emperor. But the concept of emergency powers exists in any constitutional system. And, you have controversial and famous constitutional theorist Carl Schmitt talking about it. And in fact, India's provisions relating to emergency in the constitution are actually heavily drawn from the German Weimar Republic constitution. You find a lot of similarities there. And a lot of Carl Schmitt's writing was based on the Weimar Republic constitution. So when we talk about laws and rules and all these other things, we run into this tricky situation that any set of rules, laws, or any legal system cannot survive for too long if it has no means to defend itself as a system, that it requires a suspension of that system to defend that system. And again, it is necessarily supposed to be temporary and for a purpose. And a lot of dictators become tyrants when they take away the temporary part of it and when they forget about the purpose part of it. But we have to understand that this is in a system where we are currently in a situation where it is an emergency, where the government is sort of exercising emergency powers, but we don't know exactly when this will end. We don't know exactly when the government will allow state governments to function properly, or will stop sending out these directives and these advisories and so on and so forth. And as state governments will be able to take independent decisions on their own to manage their affairs. And this sort of creates a problem for lawyers and constitutional lawyers. How do we make sense of this particular situation here?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think this is all we have time for today. We do think that this is a situation that is unfolding pretty rapidly, and we might therefore come back to it to raise some of the additional questions that relate to this. But things to think about as you know, we process the lockdown and we process all that's happening in the country is to think about the ways in which different levels of government interact with each other, what this means for our institutions, the availability of data for decision making and the politics that surround it, as well as questions of you know, the surveillance state more broadly speaking, and its effects that it could have on individuals' privacy and self-governance in that sense. And as Alok mentioned, more broadly, what the idea of emergency itself means. So we'll leave it at that for now and hope to come back. But do tune in next Wednesday for our next episode.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning into this episode. And we hope you all stay safe and you stay indoors. And we hope to catch you soon for another episode. Thank you all for tuning in. Bye-bye.
Bye.